Hello, I'm Kirsty Young, and this is a podcast from the Desert Island Discs archive. For rights reasons, we've had to shorten the music. The programme was originally broadcast in 2006, and the presenter was Sue Lawley.
My castaway this week is an actress. She's one of the great ladies of the British stage and has been at the forefront of her profession since she first appeared at the Royal Court Theatre in London half a century ago. In those days, she was identified with the New Wave, appearing in plays by writers such as Arnold Wesker and John Osborne. She went on to make her name in more established roles, winning Actress of the Year for her performance as Shaw's St. Joan, and then, through her marriage to Laurence Olivier, became closely associated with his work at Chichester and the foundation of the National Theatre. They were married for 28 years. Since his death in 1989, she's added a career in film to her theatre work. She was nominated for an Oscar for her performance in Enchanted April, and her latest film, Mrs. Palfrey at the Claremont, will be released later this year. In it, the eponymous heroine says, "Most of my life I have been somebody's daughter, somebody's wife, and somebody's mother. I would like to spend the rest of my time here being simply myself." A line she might perhaps identify with in real life. She is, of course, Dame Joan Plowright. Do you identify with Mrs. Palfrey, Joan? Do you relish now, in your mid-70s, being fully your own person?
Yes, I think I do. I don't think all my life has actually been spent as Mrs. Palfrey's was, because Mrs. Palfrey did dedicate everything to a marriage and her husband and followed him everywhere. I think I've always kept a little nugget of Joan Plowright, even when I became Lady Olivier.
You have always been your own person, really, haven't you? Your brother David has said of you when you were a girl, you know, you made no concessions to being a woman. You wanted to be captain of the football team. You wanted to be the best at everything.
I think I never actually realised there were limitations.
So you were a very modern young woman. It's not surprising, probably that you did end up in the New Wave at the Royal Court, is it?
Yes, and that was the place for all of us coming to London from the provinces.
Because you were always going to get out of the provinces, weren't you? That was always your ambition.
Yes, I didn't want to stay any longer in a small town. I mean, my mother, who had a lot of longings and yearnings for theatre, ballet, music, I think she was always telling all three of us, you must go out into a wider world.
And you fulfilled her dreams, really, perhaps, did you?
I guess I did, yes. Yes.
Tell me about your first record.
I chose this one because I've always loved Judy Garland. It's just the theme of this particular song, which I used to sing when I was a girl and dream about when I went to bed. There was a picture on my wall of kind of turrets and Persian minarets. It was so sort of exotic and far away. And it made me think, I want some sort of adventure in some world that I have never seen yet. I want to go places. I want to get out of here.
Garland singing over the rainbow from the film The Wizard of Oz, and reminds you, Dame Joan Plowright, of escaping from Scunthorpe, or dreaming of escaping from Scunthorpe. Not that, as I understand it, your father wanted you to. He was editor of the local newspaper, wasn't he? The Scunthorpe
yes.
and Frodingham Star.
Yes.
Now, he wanted you to be a journalist, didn't he?
Yes, he did. I think he thought it was such a precarious profession, the one I wanted to go into. His only experience of it had been bailing out chorus girls who'd been stranded in Gainsborough, where he first started as a cub reporter, and he thought it was a dreadful profession.
Obviously, you had your mother's genes. She was in amateur dramatics. She wanted to be a ballet dancer, hadn't she?
Oh, yes. Yes, she ran away from home, first of all, but it was not considered respectable to go into the theatre, either as a dancer or an actress. But she ran her own amateur dramatic society. When I first went home after my first success and people had sort of read about me, and I would meet solicitors in the street or something going down the high street, and they would just say, oh, well, of course, I mean, we're not at all surprised. We saw your mother as Elizabeth Barrett Browning.
So you obviously fulfilled her dreams in spades. You also married the great actor of the era, Laurence Olivier. She must have been thrilled to bits, was she, when you married him?
Not at the beginning. She wasn't quite sure what was going on at the beginning. She thought he was a bit of a philanderer. But, of course, we had both fallen in love with him as Heathcliff.
In the film of Wuthering Heights, yes.
In the film of Wuthering Heights.
But your father must have been very worried about it. I mean,
yes,
fathers don't like their daughters marrying men 22 years older than themselves,
no,
do they?
No, he was very worried at the beginning. Well, they both were, but they understood that it was a very deep love, that it was what both of us perhaps needed at that time. And I think my parents gradually realised that, you know, it was not just philandering. It was the depth of the relationship was nothing to do just with physical attraction or feeling, thinking you're falling in love. It was an ideal of something that was kind of bigger than both of us, and that is the formation of a company of actors that could be the best in the world, which is what he wanted.
Record number two.
This is really in tribute to my mother. It's Catherine Ferrier. I mean, it is also because it's a memory of my first introduction to it when she played this record to me.
My lover to me. They told me last night there were ships in the offing, and I hurried down to the deep rolling sea. But my eye could not see it, wherever might be.
Kathleen Ferrier singing Blow the Wind Southerly. You went to London for an audition, Joan, when you were just a girl of 16, for an audition in Soho. That was very daring.
Yes. My brother, who was at music college, met me and took me to this dreadful little office up some back stairs where there was a waiting room full of dyed blonde hair ladies in nylons and fur coats.
What did you look like?
I was in my school raincoat, if I remember rightly, and a berry. And it didn't occur to me that clothes and mattered all that much. I liked acting. I knew I could act.
And what did you prepare? What did you do for your audition?
Oh, I had prepared one or two things, but I never got the opportunity to do anything. He just called me in and said, look at this, various waste paper baskets full of torn-up letters. He was just telling me about the precarious nature of the profession. And after sort of 2 or 3 minutes, he just said to me, go home, my dear, go home.
That was it?
That was it. I wasn't allowed to do any audition that I'd prepared. But I did then do what, in fact, my father suggested, get more qualifications in case I needed to do something else.
But you didn't need to do something else, because in the end you won a place at the Old Vic Theatre School, didn't you?
Yes,
and
I did.
After that, you got your first part in London given to you by none other than Orson Welles. I mean, you began big.
Well, I mean, talk about, you know, dreaming of somewhere else other than Scunthorpe, yes. I auditioned for him, first of all, when he was going to do Othello, and I didn't get that. But he sort of sent a letter saying if he was doing anything else, he would remember me, and indeed he did when he was going to do this strange but brilliant production of Moby Dick. Of course, it got, you know, different sorts of reviews. And when I came in on the second night, Orson was already in his dressing room, and he called out as I went past, "Congratulations on your notices." And I, remembering only the poor reviews, said rather sulkily, "Which notices?" And he said, "You've had exactly the same mixture of notices as I have, good and bad. And I've been in the business 40 years and you're just starting. Why should you presume you will please everybody?"
Next record, number 3.
This will bring quite a few memories. It's the Halle Orchestra, and we used to attend those concerts. My parents used to have quite exuberant rows where they would smash crockery, and they would not be speaking to each other, so they would communicate through their children. So my father would say, "Ask your mother if I'm to get tickets for the Barbarolle concert next month." And then we knew, yes, everything would be all right. And the Elgar is one of the things we all heard together, and was the only time during those orchestral concerts that we ever saw my father, who was a very undemonstrative man usually, weeping. Music made him weep, and particularly this one.
Nimrod from Elgar's Enigma Variations, played by the Halle Orchestra, conducted by Sir John Barbarolle. A very important turning point came in your career, Joan Plowright, in 1956. You'd have been in your mid-20s, and you were invited to join the new wave of directors, writers and actors at the Royal Court Theatre in Sloane Square, Chelsea. I mean, the names are amazing, aren't they? Arnold Wesker and John Osborne, and Samuel Beckett, directed by George Devine, and Tony Richardson, starring Tom Courtney, Alan Bates, Albert Finney, Peter O'Toole. You really must have felt, you know, you were in the right place at the right time. You really hit the spot, didn't you?
Ah, yes, I suddenly felt, oh my goodness, now I'm where I should be. It was the first time one had been working alongside writers. I mean, John Osborne was also acting in the company before his first play was produced.
You were inevitably, of course, called an angry young woman because, you know, Osborne et al. Were called angry young men. But you weren't particularly angry. I think you were pretty delighted.
We were all labelled angry young men and women after Look Back and Anger had opened, of course. But, I mean, the fact is one did an enormous range of characters, for that was what the company was about. And I did the chairs, the Ionesco chairs, playing a 90-year-old woman, and the next one, a 17-year-old student.
But you did play B.T. Bryant, didn't you, in Wesker's Roots, and she has a kind of angry speech at the end, doesn't she, the daughter of the Norfolk farmer.
Oh, that is true. B.T. Bryant was a kind of blazing part for me, and in this final speech, she suddenly realises that she is talking for herself. And she says, and she suddenly stops in mid-flow and says, "It's me. This is me talking. I'm not quoting anymore." And that's when the curtain comes down.
Record number 4.
Well, this is very special. It is Laurence Olivier, I better say that, in a speech from Henry V, and I had written him a letter. My daughter found a schoolgirl diary which said, got a letter back from L.O. Obviously, I'd written and congratulated him. And I'm sure the letter really was from his secretary, but never mind.
Because the film was, what, about 1944, wasn't it?
Yeah.
It was just before the end of the war. So you'd have been 15.
Yes.
Writing to this great actor.
Presuming to, yes. But I also did this speech myself in the film Tea with Mussolini. So that it has many connotations. It also, of course, brings back him, his voice, and that trademark cry at the end, which other actors would try to copy and never really succeed. Anyway, just wonderful.
We few, we happy few, we band of brothers, for he today that sheds his blood with me shall be my brother, be he ne'er so base, and gentlemen in England now abed shall think themselves accursed they were not here, and hold their manhoods cheap, whilst any speaks that fought with us upon St. Crispin's Day!
Laurence Olivier delivering Henry V's St. Crispin's Day speech from the 1944 film of the play. Great stuff. You met him for the first time backstage. He came backstage to congratulate you on a performance, didn't he? You must remember the moment.
Yes. Yes, it was The Country Wife. It was my first leading part at the Royal Court. And he was very, very charming, though he said later that he saw in our eyes a kind of defiance about being invaded by the establishment.
Because he came with his then-wife Vivian Leigh, didn't he?
Yes.
But by all accounts, he was entranced by you from the very beginning.
So he says in his book, yes.
He did, he says, let me quote, Miss Joan Plowright, whose very name was enough to make me think thoughts of love. Did you think in that moment that there might be a future in it?
No, I did not. No, of course not. I was still playing in The Country Wife, and there were plans to make a film of it. And they had talked to me about the film and offered me a 7-year contract. And that was when George Devine came and asked me if I would take over the part of Jean Rice in The Entertainer with Laurence Olivier.
In the West End?
In the West End. Mm. If I had chosen to do the film, I might never have worked or met again with Laurence Olivier. Who knows?
There was rapport from the beginning, wasn't there?
Yes. Well, yes, he was teasing and called me Miss Wheelshare instead of Miss Plowright and said it was equally agricultural. Flirted quite a bit. And then I thought, well, of course, he does that all the time. You know, that's part of his charisma.
So when was the point that you thought, hang on, this is not just another flirtation, I'm feeling something and
well,
this is the beginning of something big?
He would always kind of engineer that other people around left before I did. And then he would talk, you know, about his life and that he was at a crossroads, that life had become horrendous for him and he had to make a break.
And he wanted, you said, tenderness.
He actually wanted a family life. He wanted to be still, to be solid, a life of substance, not sort of living out of a trunk and huge kind of glitzy parties, which he never enjoyed. You know, though they'd been this kind of golden couple, they were two very different people, and it had become obvious as time went by.
Next piece of music.
We finally were free to marry after quite some time of waiting. And we were both in New York. I had gone to do A Taste of Honey. George Devine and Tony Richardson had put me on in that on Broadway, and he was coming along later to do Beckett. And we went out to a little village, Wilton, Connecticut, to get to the registry office to get married. And there was a nice little lady, and we went and stood in front of her, and she said to Larry, what is your name? And he said, Laurence Olivier. And she said, and what is your profession? He said, I am an actor, ma'am. And she said, oh, that's nice. And I don't think he'd banked on being quite so anonymous as all that. And my next record is to do with the show that we both went to see and loved, and that is West Side Story. And it was something we shared a love for, and perhaps particularly this song, because it's a love song.
Was Maria from West Side Story with Leonard Bernstein conducting the New York Philharmonic. Bernstein, who of course wrote West Side Story. Just tell me a little bit more, Joan, if you would, about the period of time between falling in love and getting married, because it must have been very difficult for you. Was the press very intrusive then?
I was totally bewildered because I'd never been through anything like it before. He had, and was very worried that it would prove too much for me.
The problem would have been, though, wouldn't it, that the public would have been on the side of Vivian Leigh, as it were, because they knew about her and she would have looked vulnerable and she was older and maybe, you know, Olivier was leaving her for a younger woman. That would have been difficult for you to contend with because your relationship ran deeper than that and it wasn't just another little affair, was it?
Yes. I think, you see, quite a number of people actually did know about their marriage and the difficulties of it and the fact that divorce had been discussed.
And she'd had an affair with Peter Finch, I think, hadn't
she? Yes, exactly. Before I even met him, they had been on the verge of divorce two or three times, but it hadn't happened.
I mean, she was ill. She was a manic depressive, wasn't she?
Yes. And that is why, you know, we waited, because you didn't want to force someone with that affliction into doing something violent, which could have been possible.
Did you ever meet?
Only in theatre receptions, but that was before I was involved with Larry.
But not afterwards?
No. He didn't want us to meet because he wasn't sure what in those circumstances would happen. You see, she changed her mind rather a lot, which was difficult. She would agree to divorce one day and then change her mind the next. So that was when I said, yes, we'll have a year apart. And if the love is deep enough, it will last and we will be together. And if it isn't, it won't. But it would be put to the test.
And it passed. It passed the test.
Yes.
And you did get married, as we've heard, and you went on to have three children. What kind of father was he, Laurence Olivier?
He tried very hard to be a good father. I mean, he didn't have a lot of time, let's face it. He did once offer to take over on the nanny's day and night off and give me a break. They were babies, so he slept in the nanny's room next to the babies and said I could have a full night's sleep, but it would be absolutely fine. And I came down about 7:30 because there was quite a noise going on. And I went in, and of course, there was apple puree and baby cereal all over the floor and all over their faces and all over him. And he said, oh, thank God you've come. I'd rather play Othello 8 times a week than ever do this again.
Record number 6.
This is a bit of Mozart. Because it's been played to my grandchildren as small babies, because it is supposed to develop the brain. So I thought if it does that to small babies, it could probably retain brain power for people who are older.
And stuck on desert islands.
And stuck on a desert island.
Thank you. Kuku Uchida playing part of the first movement of Mozart's piano sonata in C major. You said, Joan, that Larry could be very difficult. I think you once said, you know, you'd have died for him, but there were times when you didn't know how to live with him. And he got more difficult, didn't he, as he got older, because he became ill. I think he developed prostate cancer and a muscle-wasting disease. There's a feeling that he really did rage against the dying of the light, didn't he?
Yes, he did. Well, who wouldn't after such a life as he'd led? I mean, he was a man touched by genius, and such men are usually also attended by demons. And he would fight to overcome those demons, and some he would and some he wouldn't. I mean, mostly he did do it very well. He did behave very well, and he displayed such courage. We had so many kind of false alarms that he did. I mean, I remember one journey when he had pneumonia and going to the hospital, and he asked the driver to go to the Old Vic, and it was in the morning, and there was not anybody much about. There was a stage carpenter, an electrician, and the stage doorkeeper. And he sort of gathered them together and sort of said goodbye. And they were all absolutely horrified when they heard his breathing. He kept saying to me, "Get him out of here, get him out of here." Which I finally did, and we got to St Thomas's, and actually all was well, and he was out again and working within a year.
He was rehearsing. He was rehearsing for the end.
Yes, yeah.
And have you felt, since his death, 17 years ago now, have you felt like the keeper of the flame? You know, different things have happened and odd mistresses have come out of the woodwork, or there have been biographies written suggesting that he might have had homosexual liaisons and things. That must be very distressing, but have you felt it's fallen to you throughout this time to defend his memory?
I don't think there's any need to defend his memory. His performances, his greatness as an artist are there, and they are there in the films, like the one we had an extract from today. And I said, if a man is touched by genius, he isn't an ordinary person. He doesn't lead an ordinary life. He has extremes of behaviour which you understand, and you just find a way not to be swept overboard by his demons. You kind of stand apart, continue your own work and your absorption in the family, and those other things don't really matter, finally.
Next piece of music, number 7.
Well, now, when we were at the National Theatre, we had the invasion of Franco Zeffirelli, and then the happiest one, the Neapolitan Eduardo Di Filippo, Saturday, Sunday, Monday, in which Larry played the grandpapa, I played Mama, and Frank Finlay was the father. The setting was a big kind of Sunday lunch, huge table, and everybody came on to take their call, and the great big table, the dining table, was there just empty. Everybody came on, took a bow, and then rushed off and got a plate or the cloth. By the time Frank and I came on together to take the final call, the table was set and we just went to our places, and then everybody raised their glasses to the audience, and it brought the house down. And this was the tune that was played during it.
Quando mamma te l'ha fatto, quando mamma te l'ha fatto, vuoi sapere come facette, vuoi sapere come facette, mi bastasti carne bella, mi bastasti carne bella, tutto quello che mettete, tutto quello che mettete, cento rose ingappucciate, linda marta l'anniscate, latte rosa, rosa e latte, del facente un coppo fatto.
That was Giuseppe Di Stefano singing Come Facetta Mametta, How Do You Do It, Mama, a Neapolitan folk song. Joan Plowright, more professional plans in the pipeline, or are you spending more time with your grandchildren these days?
There are one or two things in the pipeline, but not really much point in talking about them until they materialise.
But you want to do more, is the point?
Very occasionally. And I quite like to have the time to just enjoy the art of living, which I haven't had a lot of time to do in a very busy life. And I've had no time to stand and stare.
Well, you can do it, of course, on your desert island and reflect on what's obviously been really quite a, not just a busy but a tumultuous life. Do you think when you sit on the sand and think about it, are you going to have any regrets?
No, I wouldn't. I wouldn't have those because I believe there is a kind of destiny. I know you make choices, but I think what turns out is what is meant. Because something guided those choices, which is very personal and to do with you, and it's your tapestry you are weaving, and you've learned a great deal from it and experienced great joy and sorrow, and that makes you a more rounded human being.
Last record.
The last record is, I guess, a kind of statement. It's Edith Piaf. Again, a vulnerability, quite a tough life, like Judy Garland, but emerged from it. And it is atmospheric, reminds you of cafes in France and sitting on the sidewalk and having coffee or Pernod, and all the things that Paris is. And anyway, Piaf.
Non, rien de rien. Non, je ne regrette rien. Ni le bien qu'on m'a fait, ni le mal, tout ça m'est bien égal. Non, rien de rien. Non,
well,
je ne regrette rien.
Non, je ne regrette rien. If you could only take one of those eight records, which one would you take, Joan?
I would take the Mozart, in that I would spend the rest of my life getting the fingering right. In other words, I'm going to take a piano.
Well, that's your luxury.
That is my luxury.
All right.
And I will practice that Mozart sonata for the rest of my life on the desert island, and think of my grandchildren who'll be sort of grown-up young men and women then.
And you can take a book to read as well as the Bible and the complete works of Shakespeare.
Yes, indeed. And I've decided, after long thought, to take Marcel Proust, Remembrance of Things Past, à la recherche du temps perdu, because it's epic. It takes you such a long time to get to the end of one sentence. And there is such a wonderful love affair between the boy and his grandmother, and as a grandmother now, and with grandsons. I recognise it, and it's very moving.
That's the book.
That's the book.
Dame Joan Plowright, thank you very much indeed for letting us hear your Desert Island Discs.
Thank you.
You've been listening to a podcast from the Desert Island Discs archive. For more podcasts, please visit bbc.co.uk/radio4.